Hello and welcome to the Metrospective presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70 celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. I'm Ted Berg, joined on the line as always by the Athletics Mets beat writer Tim Britton. Tim, I have a question for you. In the age of text messaging, do you believe that there are appropriate and inappropriate times to text people?
Ted, there are inappropriate and appropriate times to ask questions on this podcast, and that's at the end of the podcast. We don't do questions yet.
That's true. It's a logistic thing because it was like 6 a.m. this morning. I was like, I really need to text Tim and make sure we're on board for the same time. But then and for me, because I don't need to be near my phone. Like sometimes I wake up to 36 text messages from a crazy baseball thread of my friends drunk and yelling at each other, which is what happened last night. But my wife, who does need to have her phone, when people text her in the night, then that like wakes up our whole family. And sometimes it's just her friends being, you know, like chatting. Do you, as a journalist, are you someone with your phone on all the time?
My phone is always on, and it's next to my bed because it is also my alarm clock. But I don't think texts wake me up in general.
You don't have like a special thing for my texts that like it is like an emergency, like that. What if there's a podcast that needs to be done right now?
Is do not disturb a special thing? Because I have that definitely for you.
Good.
It's funny. I actually had no idea what time you had texted me this morning. I was like, wait, what time was that? And I was in the process of being awake at that point.
I want to say
almost there.
Just so the people know, I waited until 9 a.m. I thought I was like 9 a.m. seems like a fair time to text someone.
You know how they say in like football when a guy's like in the process of making a football move? Like I was in the process of making an awake move to get out of bed at that point.
All right. Well, I'm glad I anticipated. We promised we would talk a little bit about what team Mets fans should pull for in the postseason. In the time since I made that promise, the picture has gotten a lot more complicated.
Yeah, so we obviously the Yankees and Cardinals, teams that Mets fans generally love watching and rooting for and pulling for, and you know, basically their second and third favorite teams. If that's correct, right? You know,
yeah,
they're out. So Mets fans devastated by the loss of the Yankees and Cardinals in the playoffs.
You know,
go ahead.
I think this is an oddity among Mets fans, but I don't hate the Yankees as like I actually kind of feel like the Yankees are the lesser of two evils with the Red Sox at this point, just because the Red Sox have had so much success in the past 15 years or whatever it is, 17 years now. And I think it's probably just because the Red Sox fans I hang out with tend to be more obnoxious than the Yankee fans I hang out with, which is not, I guess, to be expected, but it's just how it plays out. And so I find myself, almost in spite of myself, in a Red Sox-Yankees matchup, like in the wild card game, pulling for the Yankees. I think especially this season, just because of how bad they were in the middle of the year and how down on them Yankees fans. I know we spoke about it on the show, like listening to WFAN sometimes and in the middle of the season and hearing Yankee fans like jumping off bridges because they were, you know, the analytics has destroyed this team. There was like a little bit of, I found a little bit of joy in knowing that that set of Yankees fans would be wrong if the team went deep into the postseason. So I was a little disappointed for the Red Sox to advance.
Well, I do not sympathize with that point of view because I don't think that the type of Yankees fan who like despises this team in July would feel a comeuppance if they advanced far in October. It would be like, I knew all along. You know, I was
about
on board
time
with this team all along. Yeah. So I don't sympathize with the Yankees. I do kind of enjoy this place they've gotten to where it reminds me of like the Cowboys for a while, where they're good on a consistent basis, but they can't get over the hump. And that like being good and just getting to the ALCS or getting to, I mean, the Cowboys haven't been NFC championship game in like 25 years, but getting, you know, to the playoffs or to the second round of the playoffs is not good enough for the fan base. And that's all they've been able to do for a while. As like a Duke basketball fan, like getting to the Sweet 16 is like, oh God, this terrible team. And it's interesting to see how Yankees fans react to that dynamic. So I'm okay with it. You know, you can feel terrible for them. I'm okay.
To me, the clear pick, and they remain so, but we speak on Tuesday morning, they are at risk of elimination by late Tuesday afternoon. The White Sox, because, you know, for being an underdog, and I think especially for being like the clear second favorite team in their market, obviously the Cubs are not the Yankees. They have not had the Yankees' success. They are themselves so often lovable losers. But because the White Sox seem so often an afterthought in Chicago baseball, and because, you know, Tony La Russa notwithstanding, they have a really fun team, that was, to me, like the obvious pick for, you know, postseason rooting interest this year. It, you know, they now face an uphill battle down 2-1 in a series against the Astros.
Yeah, and it's also fun to root against the Astros. I thought like last year's playoffs were in particular frustrating to watch the Astros because they weren't, like, they shouldn't have been in the playoffs. They finished under 500, and then they dispatched two teams who have like historically had good regular seasons and done terribly in the playoffs in Minnesota and Oakland. It's like, oh, this team's not even supposed to be here, and they're beating us again. With the White Sox, yeah, I think, you know, that offense is really fun to watch. They've got a couple pitchers who I like watching in Giolito and Carlos Rodon. I actually hadn't seen Dylan Cease at all until I watched a little bit of Game 3. I feel like he's better than my perspective of him from Game 3. You know, they've got a lot of fun young players. I do think, like, you know, you can make the comparison between like the Mets and the White Sox. I do feel like for Mets fans, the White Sox is a worse outcome to root for them because, you know, the Mets, they've only won their two championships, but they've won extremely memorable championships. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you know the Miracle Mets of 69. You know the 86 Mets is this very memorable baseball team who won a championship in this incredible fashion. Whereas, like, you know, the White Sox have their one title in the last century, in 2005, that routinely gets washed over, that no one remembers, even though that was like a very good team that went 11-1 in the playoffs, and is just kind of like lost to history already 16 years later.
I did a crazy road trip that summer, and with my friends from college, and we hit like 15 stadiums in 21 days or something absurd, including a stop at I don't know what it was called at that point. It might have been US Cellular already, but and, you know, at the White Sox park, and that atmosphere when the White Sox were good was one. It's something like I frequently cite as like, this is one of the most fun baseball experiences I've had. I think I'm so nostalgic for the symmetrical municipal park, like the Shea Stadium style, and that's really like one of the last of those. And it was like sort of this very poorly timed thing where it was the last stadium built before Camden Yards. And so like I have a little bit of just a feeling for that type of place, I guess. The place was just bouncing the way like Shea Stadium did, where it's like that, the concrete foundations sort of erupting at every moment. And so I don't forget the 2005 White Sox, I'll say.
Yeah, and one of the things I like about that team is, like, you know, it's like, I don't think there's a guy who's even going to come close to the Hall of Fame on that team, right? Like, it's Burley maybe, mm-hmm, would have the best chance. He's not going to make it. Then it's Konerko. It's just like a bunch of dudes who had good years.
Total White Sox dudes, too. Like the two guys you just mentioned are like the White Soxiest guys.
I'm actually looking at their page. They had a much worse offense than I realized. Like, almost everyone has an OPS plus below 100. It's basically Konerko and Jermaine Dye.
Yeah.
Another guy. But that pitching staff, obviously, like the ALCS, they got, what was it, two outs from the bullpen the entire ALCS?
Yeah, and I, like, basically no one missed a start during the season.
Yeah, so, like, that is a team that, like, you describe that their starting staff threw 44 and a third innings in a five-game ALCS. You'd be like, oh, what year did that happen? 1948 or something? No, it was 2005. And another guy who actually really likes that team is Pete Alonso. Because Pete Alonso, a big Paul Konerko fan.
That's a good fit.
liked the way, you know, thought Konerko was a guy who kind of matched his swing. So watched a lot of, you know, Alonso is a bit young to have watched that team like in depth as a, he probably was in like fourth grade or something for it. But really liked Konerko, watched his YouTube highlights a bunch. So actually the first time I ever talked to Pete Alonso, this was in 2018 in Binghamton early in the year, or it was somewhere, Binghamton was on the road. I think it was in Manchester, New Hampshire. And he just started talking about the about Konerko and the White Sox, how much he loved that team. Like, he watches a lot of their highlights. And I was using, like, my reporter's notebook. You know, some stadiums give it to you for free. And I had a White Sox reporter's notebook because the Red Sox had been there the year before, and I had it for free. And so he was like, oh, White Sox, so you're a big White Sox fan. And I was like,
yes.
No, I just got it for free. He's like, yeah, so you know all about Konerko, you know Aaron Rowand and all this. And I was like, I thought to myself, am I going to have to pretend to Pete Alonso for the next decade and a half that I like the White Sox?
Yeah.
But it he has forgotten my White Sox notebook, thankfully.
He still loves
that team.
That makes me like Pete Alonso more, and kind of makes me like the 2005 White Sox more. Like, that's a nice little connection there. And it's funny, like, Konerko is a guy I think about when I think about like long term prospects for Alonso. Sometimes, even though Alonso, it's worth noting, like, because of the difference in era, Alonso has been an appreciably better hitter in the early parts of their career, and Konerko was a really good player for a very long time, but just like a little more top end power from Pete Alonso to date. But yeah, like a righty hitting first baseman who is very good and doesn't quite feel like a Hall of Famer.
Yeah, and Konerko, Alonso, first of all, is like a better baseball historian than I would have expected for someone his age. Mm-hmm. A couple of years ago, we were at, I think we were in Milwaukee, and, you know, the Brewers have retired Hank Aaron's number in addition to the Braves. And so I wondered, like, how many players have had their numbers retired by multiple teams. And I looked this up, and I was talking about it with one of the Mets PR staffers, and Alonso hears us, and he's like, oh, what are you guys talking about? And we tell him, and he, like, you know, there's something like 11 or 12, and he named like 10 of them. Like, he knew, he's like, oh, it must be this guy and this guy. And I was very impressed. And speaking of Konerko, one thing I thought about earlier this year was, if you look at, like, I was trying to find historical analogs for Francisco Lindor, for a guy who's very good and then goes through a prolonged stretch of being bad. And could he bounce back from that? And Konerko, if you look at his 2003,
yeah,
had basically the two worst months of his career at the start of that year. Might have been even longer than that. And then rebounded to essentially be the same player he'd always been, mm-hmm, for the next 9 years. And so I think if you're looking for a good case scenario for Francisco Lindor, it is once again Paul Konerko.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
If the White Sox don't advance, maybe this is a question for me, but if the White Sox don't advance, what is a Mets fan to do?
Yeah, I would say, you know, there's the other team that could be one of the other teams that could be eliminated on Tuesday in Milwaukee,
right,
because that's a team that has never won a World Series, hasn't been to a World Series in just about 40 years.
Well, and they're not the Braves.
And they're not the Atlanta Braves. And they have, you know, if you're a Mets fan, you generally tend to be a guy who appreciates fine starting pitching. And the Brewers are built off of that, perhaps too much so. And then I would say, yeah, the American League does not look promising for a Mets fan. There is some kindred spirit with the Red Sox fan because of the hatred of the Yankees, but I believe that has been eroded, as you said, over the last decade and a half.
Yeah, I don't feel it at all. I feel more kinship with my fellow New Yorker than with the Bostonite.
How do you feel about the Giants? Because that's horribly. A team that has won three out of five last decade, and you know, but still has this underdog feel to them, even though it's some of the same guys.
I have no patience whatsoever. It's personal. Two of my best friends from college are rather obnoxious San Francisco Giants fans, and you know, like everyone, I only want sadness for my friends. And so I don't want them to get, especially this year. Like, this is a weird thing. It's a cool thing that they were good. Another of my friends, has, like, we talked about it recently. It's like, if you were to like pull the baseball lever all again for 2021, like, how many times would the Giants wind up a 106 win team? It feels like very, very unlikely it would happen, very often. But and on the same text chain that I mentioned with 35 messages last night, there are also two completely separate. One is not that obnoxious, but one is especially obnoxious, San Francisco Giants fans. And I can't abide any of my friends having any sort of lasting enjoyment from baseball. So the Giants are out. Like, I pull for the Dodgers over the Giants for sure.
See, I'm different on that. I don't want to pull for the Dodgers at this point. They've got enough going for them this year and in the past decade and going forward. One thing that does strike me as we talk about this, like the Red Sox and Giants are pretty good examples of why you shouldn't be sure about where your team is on the window of contention. You know, I wrote about Marcus Stroman for Monday Morning and kind of, you know, what it would cost potentially to re-sign him. Something in the range of 4 years and $80 million is what I projected. But, you know, it wouldn't actually surprise me if it got a little bit higher than that because of his durability. And some of the, you know, this is not everyone's, I don't want to like generalize the entire commentariat, but there are some people who have suggested, like, you know, the Mets aren't there yet. This should not be how they invest their money. They're not close enough to being a contending team to put that much money down on, you know, a guy who would be their number two starting pitcher. And I look at San Francisco and Boston, and you think, like, that kind of idea would probably prevent you from signing from a lot of the moves that those teams made in the last year. You know, I guess the Red Sox might not be the best example. They didn't make like big expenditures. I think the priciest free agent that they signed was Kike Hernandez for 2 years and $14 million. At the same time, I think you can probably use the same dismissive approach. Like, you know, why are we signing that guy? If we're not going to be that close, we should just, you know, leave center field open to Jaron Duran or something if you're a Red Sox fan.
Right.
And with the Giants, it was, you know, giving the qualifying offer to Kevin Gausman. It's signing Alex Wood. It's signing Anthony DeSclafani and some of those smaller moves. But, you know, like, if you hit on those, you can be a really good team. Like, every year there are enough free agents that if you sign them to smaller deals, and, you know, Stroman would be a bigger, longer term one, but he's a better player than a lot of these guys. And you hit on them, like, you can be a really good team. You know, this is the old, I forget what year it was. I think it was Sam Miller at ESPN wrote, like, how can we make the Tigers good just with free agents? And, like, you could build a pretty good team for, like, $50 million in free agent expenditures. So I think I don't want to be, like, I am not sure, and I don't think too many people should be sure about how far away the Mets are from contending. I don't think it's impossible to imagine them building a team in the next several months that can win 100 games, because we just saw it happen with a team that was worse than them in San Francisco.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I'll say, like, I think back to the Astros. Like, everybody knew the Astros after they tanked for those 4 years, and when they had this new front office full of hotshots, like, it felt like everybody knew they were going to be good. And then in 2015, it was like they sort of jumped ahead of that timeline a little bit and wound up a game away from the ALCS. Like, I think when the team's heading in the right direction and building the, like, putting the right pieces together, sometimes it can happen faster than you expect. And, like, you kind of got to surf that wave when it comes, because you don't know. It's never guaranteed, right?
And the other thing is kind of going back to the comparison between the Mets where they are now under Steve Cohen and where the Dodgers were when they were first bought by their current ownership group in 2012. You know, what you spend on the major league team doesn't necessarily take away from your construction of infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Like the Dodgers then were putting a lot into their minor league system, but they also went out and made the Adrian Gonzalez, Josh Beckett, Carl Crawford trade because they wanted to be good at the major league level at the same time. So even if your end goal is this sustainable player development machine that brings up new guys and constantly has prospects who are ready to fill in at the major league level and fill in well, you know, before you get to that point, and the Mets are not at that point currently, before you build a farm system, you know, while you're building that farm system, you don't have to suck at the major league level. Like, you can be good still. You can spend money on being good and covering up the holes in your system in the short term through free agency and through trades.
Yeah, and you know, it's that this is something that has changed for me over time. But I think, like, I have so much an appreciation for the teams that can do that, that can, you know, build a winner while building up a farm system, that like this is not a popular opinion. I like the Astros. Like, I know they're the team that cheated. I know. They're a cool team. Like, I just don't know. I don't know how to say it on their any other way. Like, they've just done such a good job sort of replenishing themselves throughout. Like, if you look at their starting rotation this year. Like, obviously, they have Zach Greinke. They have Lance McCullers. Those are guys we know. Luis Garcia, Framber Valdez, and Jose Urquidy are, like, big. We're all, like, had really nice seasons in the Astros starting rotation. Like, it feels like they are just constantly finding that next guy, constantly promoting from within, you know, good new young players. Kyle Tucker had a huge season this year. Yordan Alvarez has been huge. He's 24. It's like almost in, no, it's not in spite of myself. Like, I don't know. A lot of people are so upset about the banging on a garbage can thing. My take has always been, like, way more teams did stuff like that than you're ever going to find out. When they talked about Beltran, they said, like, you know, Beltran brought some stuff over from the Yankees, and like all Yankee fans will forget they ever heard that. And forget that there was any chance that the Yankees were doing similar things. Maybe not to the same extent, but I think there's a really good chance that lots of teams have done stuff like that in recent seasons. Maybe now, after the scrutiny on the Astros and to a lesser extent the Red Sox, they've cut down on it. Hopefully you want a level playing field, but it's like, I don't know. I've never had a ton of room for, like, finding the moral high ground as a baseball fan. And so once you're sort of resigned to the fact that, like, professional athletes are going to try to find whatever advantage they can, and sometimes it's going to be one that's not necessarily legal, then I can kind of like put that aside and just say, like, you know what, like, Jose Altuve is cool, Alex Bregman is a super fun player to watch, Carlos Correa is awesome, like, I kind of like the Astros.
Yeah, I mean, those guys are really fun to watch. I remember back in 2017, you know, when they're in the World Series for the first time against the Dodgers, really enjoying watching that team. And feeling conflicted already, because I did not, like, I don't like teams being rewarded for tanking, because it creates an environment, the atmosphere we're in currently.
But that's the league. That's on the league.
Where too many teams are trying. Right. Yeah, I mean, it's on everyone else for thinking they can do the same thing. But I didn't like, you know, I knew if they won, we were just going to get more teams that tanked. Whereas, you know, if they got there and lost a few times, and maybe teams would not take that approach as much. I think I've mentioned on the podcast before, like the Oklahoma City Thunder never winning an NBA title. While I felt bad for the fan base, I thought that was good for the NBA. In the same way that, like, I think if the Sixers never win, I think that would be good for the NBA, because those teams tanked to get draft picks. So I don't like the kind of ruthless way the Astros were constructed. Evan Drellick with The Athletic has written about it, going back to his time covering that team specifically in Houston, about kind of like the McKinseyization of a front office. And I don't like that development.
Well, and there was so much resentment from the players toward the front office when that was going on at the start, at the very least.
Right. I do think, going back to the sign stealing, that I was surprised at the level of outrage from other players, which suggested to me that this level of espionage was not as prevalent as I might have thought initially. That, you know, if every team does it, no team did it to that extent. It is like, you know, Altuve, Correa, Bregman in particular, Alvarez too. There are a lot of hitters on that team. It's just, man, it's really fun to watch, and I want to just appreciate them without thinking about that other thing, which is why it's almost going to be good for some of them, I think, to move on elsewhere. Like, you know, for George Springer to have the season he had in Toronto, for Correa, who you would think is probably going elsewhere after this season, to do it kind of outside of Houston. Because even if that team is better on the road than it is at home, the way it was this season, those whispers from guys like Ryan Tepera are going to follow them for a while.
Yeah, I would say, I think the first page of the denial playbook is like outrage when people do the same things that you do, right? Like that is like also like textbook fascism. It's just like blame everybody else for the thing that you yourself are doing. And because if you think back to the steroid era, like it was some of the loudest protesters, right? Rafael Palmeiro is the guy like who was first associated with like, oh no way, this guy can't be doing it because he whacked his finger and said he didn't. And then sure enough, you know, Rafael Palmeiro gets popped for steroids. So again, like it's just like, I tend to just take everything like just, I try to avoid the whole like moral ethical outcomes of it because it's only a slippery slope. Like there's no firm footing. There's no team where you can say like, oh, this is the one club where every single guy and every single member of the front office, like everyone's on the, you know, doing everything on the up and up. Like I just don't think that exists.
Are you suggesting that maturing as an adult and as an informed baseball fan has in some ways made you cynical?
Yeah, I think I was probably precociously cynical myself, but certainly nothing has changed over time. Do we have updates on the Mets' hunt for a new person to make a baseball team? I don't even know. We don't know what to call.
I think maybe that should be the title. We talked about title inflation last week. It should be the person who makes the team. So, you know, since we last talked, we recorded this last Tuesday also. That was before they had officially reached out to Theo Epstein. We said on the podcast last week that this was not going to work out with Theo Epstein. It was not what he wanted. And then we found out shortly thereafter, maybe even before the episode posted, that indeed this was not what Theo Epstein wanted. And the Mets and him have decided not to continue talking. The next step is probably Billy Bean. Billy Bean, I have heard, and others have also reported this, that he's a little bit more interested in having that conversation than Theo was. So I think that makes it, you know, it's more plausible. Is it likely? Probably not. But he's got more of an open ear to what Steve Cohen and Sandy Alderson are pitching than Epstein did. Beyond that, then you've got David Stearns, who you've got to wait on until the Brewers are out of the playoffs. So from that perspective, maybe a Mets fan doesn't root for the Brewers because the quicker they're out, the easier it is to have that conversation. At the same point, I think it's probably unlikely that the Brewers would even allow David Stearns to have that conversation unless he kind of goes into the room with Mark Attanasio, the owner, and says, like, I am leaving after next season unless you let me have this conversation with them, in which case you can get some compensation for me. So that's where they're at right now. The other thing that's happened in the last week is Zach Scott's DWI charge, and it will now go to trial in early December. I think, you know, the Mets had talked about, or Sandy Alderson had said, they were waiting on a resolution to that before making a decision on whether to reinstate Scott from his administrative leave or, you would presume, letting him go for good. And now that's being dragged out another 2 months. I am not personally sure how to interpret that this is going to try. I don't know of DWI or DUI trials in the past. I'm guessing it suggests that he thinks there's compelling evidence that would get him off for this, that would lead to an acquittal or not guilty or pleading to a lesser charge or something like that. So I guess there is that chance. It just create, you know, there's that additional layer of uncertainty, because my understanding is he's still on administrative leave and is like not really doing anything for the Mets. Not they're not looping him into conversations at this point, which just, you know, leaves that front office as vacant as ever.
Yeah, I also wonder, and again, like, this is, I'm completely speaking on speculation, but like, I guess there's, it's unclear, like, if there's potential like, can you fire someone for, like, and I think they have probably grounds to move on from him, certainly beyond the DUI, but I would wonder, like, if they open themselves up for some sort of lawsuit, if it looks like they've fired him for this alleged crime that now he's going to fight in court, and like, if he beats it, then I don't think that's legal to fire someone for a crime that they legally weren't like guilty of, right?
Yeah, I mean, they could. I think it would be difficult for them at this point to, I guess, fire him for cause.
This is,
on that.
This is well-informed law talk with Ted and Tim.
Check out our legal podcast. It runs on Thursdays. Of us being like, I think, and don't quote me on
stuff.
This.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens with him over the next 6-7 weeks. I guess
we have a question from at Sports Angle Brian, a guy we both know, and it's a good question, and it's a little different for now, which is fun. He wants to know if you and Tim were to receive one random Mets jersey of a player never commonly seen in stores, who is it? I guess, who would you want it to be? He says for him, he's always wanted Shinjo. I feel that. He said they used to stock that. News to me. He already has Oliver Perez, which is impressive, and that he would go with Cid Fernandez or Kevin McReynolds, who were actually two of my favorites as a kid.
Yeah, so I mean, I have a couple already that that are good. Good finds in Timo Perez.
Oh, that's a good one.
And Rick Reed. So I like both of those.
Yeah, you're making a complicated labor stance with Rick Reed.
that is true. I hadn't thought of that. Okay. I saw in Boston late in the season for the first time. I think this is the first time I've ever seen it. A John Olerud Mets jersey, which I very much
one
appreciated.
Of my favorites.
I think that would be, you know, I don't know how prevalent the Olerud fives were back in 98, 99. I would think they were around a bit, but they're not something you see now in like the Mets store. So I think that would be one. I also loved Melvin Mora during the night. I fell in love with like guys who just had good postseasons. So Melvin Mora in 99 and Timo Perez in 2000. Both, I think, wore number 6. I would be all about a Melvin Mora jersey as well.
Have you ever had the opportunity to speak to Melvin Mora?
So I've never spoken to him. I did a couple years ago when I did a story on the Robin Ventura Grand Slam single. I had called a bunch of Mets, and I got Melvin Mora's number, and I called him, and he didn't get back to me in time for the story. He called me something like 2 months later, and left a message on my machine that was like, "Tim, I'm sorry, I just got your message," or something, because he'd been traveling, and he just ended up like, "Let's talk Mets."
He is a prince. And he is like the nicest dude.
So I felt like, I was like, man, the story's wrong, but I need to come up with something to talk to Melvin Mora about, but I didn't. So I still have his number, which, you know, if I need to call him, I'll give him 6 months in advance notice so that it can happen.
We used to do like a series for SNY with like visiting players coming back to the Mets. And that was the one that always stands out to me. Like I teared up a little bit talking to Melvin Mora just because. He was so cool. Like, he was just like, it's rare when you meet someone that like you, like for him, I was 18 in 1999. So it was like still very much like formulating heroes, and mostly they wind up disappointing you a little bit. But Melvin Mora was like, this is a man like I want to just like hang out with and have a big bear hug with, because he was an important part of my 1999, or at least the fall of my 1999. Like, that was definitely someone whose jersey I considered for this question. Others, I'm definitely drawn to that set of teams, the 99-2000 teams. So like Benny Agbayani jumped to my mind immediately, especially because he got the Hawaii 5-0 thing, which he shared with Cid Fernandez. Another one that, you know, it feels like they might have sold his jersey just because there was enough hype about him coming up. But Jay Payton, like, I think it would be, if I saw someone with a Jay Payton jersey, I'd be like, that person's cool. You know, like, I think it's like the type of thing where you just be like, oh, this person's wearing, like, you're rocking Jay Payton. Like, yeah, like, we can hang out.
The other one that I thought about when I saw the question was Matt Franco. Mm-hmm. Because Matt Franco is someone who, like, I always think of very fondly because of, obviously, the walk-off off of Rivera. And, like, in my mind,
Matt
Franco
them. Was... I felt like he had clutch hits all the time.
A very clutch hitter, amazing pinch hitter. And then you look at his stats, you're like, ah, Matt Franco hit 230 that year, like with a 680 OPS in the middle of the steroid era. But it just seemed kind of in the way that we've talked about with Jose Peraza this past year, that all of Matt Franco's pinch hit walks, all of his pinch hits came in big situations.
A guy like that, like before on a lesser team, before Matt Franco, who I also, and like this is a deep pull. I don't know that a lot of Mets fans remember him, but they had an outfielder in 95 and 96 named Chris Jones. And Chris Jones, you know, he wasn't an everyday player, but I felt like that guy was like Mr. Huge pinch hit home run at the end of the game. Like that was another, also a number five and another one I thought of. Like, I think Jones five, no one would know. Everyone would think your name was Jones and you went to fantasy camp. but it would be, if you knew it was Chris Jones, it would be like, again, that guy's cool.
Yeah, was it 1 year? So in 95, he had three pinch hit home runs as a pinch hitter that year. 10 for 25, two doubles, three homers, 10 RBIs, a 1309 pinch hit OPS. So he was, I seem to remember him hitting a big home run in like San Francisco that had hit the foul pole or something. That name, yeah, like when I was looking up good pinch hitters for the Mets earlier this year because of what Brandon Drury was doing in July, Chris Jones was the guy who came up the quickest for what he did in the mid-90s.
Alex Ochoa, another one I thought about. Like, you know, like again, like these are like pretty deep pulls, but if they...
Hit for the cycle with the Mets, right?
I believe that's right. Yeah, he was like the first time I ever heard the term five-tool prospect was in terms of Alex Ochoa.
Yeah, so I mean, we're both going to talk about the same general era, but that you know, if we want to honor the 2005 White Sox, we could also talk about Jose Valentin, an underrated member of the 2006.
Yeah,
Mets.
That's a good one. That's Jose Valentin. I forgot about him, but he is a big, obviously, because of the mustache. Like that was just it was razor sharp, and so was he. I feel like that's a good place to end.
Yeah, it's always a good place to end talking about Jose Valentin.
We will speak again next week. Maybe there will be Mets news. More likely there won't, but we will certainly have Mets-related information to discuss.
That's a great teaser. Yeah. Everyone's very excited to come back
next
week.
Stay tuned. Maybe we'll talk more about members of the 1996 Mets. Dave Tailgater.
Adios.
Peace.